Hey, it's Brian. If you've ever thought about a career in sports, you need to check out the Master's in Sports Administration program at Northwestern University. You will learn essential skills from experienced faculty with connections to college, professional, and amateur athletics. You can choose a specialization in sports analytics and get in on this growing field. Earn your Northwestern master's degree online or in convenient evening classes. Find out more at sps.northwestern.edu/sports. One more time, sps.northwestern.edu/sports. And the Work in Sports podcast is brought to you by the Work in Sports Academy. A recent survey by McGraw-Hill identified that 40% of recent college graduates felt unprepared to enter the workforce. That's crazy. They cited a lack of knowledge in resume writing, job searching, and networking as major contributors to their anxiety. Well, you have the opportunity to be different, because all of those skills and much more are what I teach as part of our Work in Sports Academy suite of online courses. And it's about $300,000 cheaper than your college education, but will make a huge impact on your future. Check it out today, workinsports.com/academy. All right, let's start the countdown.
5, 4, 3, 2, 1, 0, ignition, liftoff.
Hey everybody, I'm Brian Clapp, VP of Content and Engaged Learning at workinsports.com, and this is the Work in Sports podcast. Something struck me the other day as I was writing the outline for one of our episodes. When I was in college, I wouldn't have been the target market for this podcast. All right, let me explain. Flashback to 1995. I'm a college junior at the University of Delaware. Solid B-plus student, involved in some clubs, done some interviews, playing some intramurals, loving sports, all of and everything that went around with it. But I would not have listened to this podcast if it had existed, which it didn't, because we barely even had cell phones and email then. But I wouldn't have listened to it, because I was always all about the sports events, the sports talk, the sports debate, the highlights, the dunks, the grand slams, blah, blah, blah. I thought the sports business shows that aired on Saturday mornings on ESPN were just the most boring thing in the world. I thought I had it made no matter what. I didn't need to listen to stuff like this podcast, or I didn't need to listen to other people's advice for building my career or learning professional development or doing that extra internship or learning a little bit more about the sports business world. And part of that was just because of the messaging we were getting. We weren't being hammered over the head with how hard it was to get a job or how competitive it was out there. I was just having a good time cruising through life. Bottom line, I would have really stunk in today's work environment if I had the same attitude. Times have changed. And while I still feel like a 20-year-old kid, seriously, I do, I know what worked when I was actually 20 would not work now. Which brings up a really interesting question. What about what works now? How will it change in the future? How will it change even 5 years from now? Our world is changing exponentially. Allow me to riff for a second. I went to Europe about 10 years ago. We visited Charlemagne's castle in Germany, which they began construction on in 792, long time ago. Beautiful structure, very cool to walk around and check out. Okay. Then we went to Edinburgh. I just like to say Edinburgh. I don't know if I'm pronouncing it right, but somebody who's Scottish and listening is probably like, oh, it just like fingernails on the chalkboard hearing me say it, but I'm going to go with it, Edinburgh. And of course, we visited Edinburgh Castle. And I bought a kilt because I was totally cliche tourist guy. Anyway, the point is that castle was built in 1130. So that was nearly 350 years later than building of Charlemagne's castle construction there. You know what's remarkable? The castles weren't all that different. Sure, there was different styles and size and scale and scope and blah, blah, blah. But really, they were both remarkable stone built structures that stood the test of time. Over 350 years, and technology and construction hadn't really changed all that much. Now just think of the last 10 years of your life. Think how many drastically different inventions have come about. Think how different the global existence is today in connectivity. We're not talking hundreds of years, we're talking exponential change over a decade. Now, I'm not here to tell you whether that's good or bad. I'm just telling you it is happening. So we all have to be on top of what is next and what is coming. You can't just stick with what you're doing. You have to be flexible and adaptable, and you have to listen. Some people have a knack for knowing what's on the horizon. Like today's guest, Joan Lynch, Chief Content and Programming Officer at Working Nation. And prior to becoming a top dog at Working Nation, she was a VP of Content Development at ESPN. So you know I'm going to ask some questions about that too. Here's Joan Lynch. Hi, Joan. How are you doing today?
I'm great. How are you?
I'm good. I am really excited to talk to you about the future of employment in the sports industry. It's a huge conversation. But before we get into that, I always like to get into the background of the people that I'm speaking with. And let's dig into you a little bit. ABC News, Yahoo, ESPN, you've had a really impressive career to date, all on the content side of the news and sports industry. So what about you? What was your motivation? What led you to the content side? And why did this feel like such a great fit for you?
You know, I had originally, my goal in life was to be an on-air play-by-play announcer for hockey, which was my passion. I'm a Philadelphia Flyers born and raised fan. And so I always really wanted to be in the sports industry and wanted to be on that side, which is what led me to go to school for a co-op program so that I could go into the journalism side. But I ended up at ABC News doing a co-op, and somebody called in sick on an election night, and I got pulled over into the news side and got stuck there, I guess, but for about 12 years.
Got stuck there. I like that. That's the right attitude, right? So basically, You kind of wish you were on the ice with Gritty in Flyers, but you ended up stuck in the content world on the broadcast side.
That's right. That's right.
I live outside of Philly.
Covering a lot more serious.
I actually live outside of Philly, but I'm actually from Boston. So that's why when you said you were a Flyers fan, I was like, uh-oh. But that's cool. We can get past that.
I think we can just agree to disagree.
So you spent 7 years total at ESPN. The first 2.5, you're an executive producer, creating and developing many of the non-scripted programming on the network. Poker, reality, game shows,
right.
Pretty cool stuff. As an EP, Explain it to a lot of the people in our audience. Our audience is a lot of times discovering new opportunities in the world, and they might not necessarily know what an EP does, but you're overseeing the entire process, both the creative and the business side. Tell us a little bit more about what that experience was like and how you manage those challenges in the role.
Sure. So overseeing unscripted at ESPN is an interesting position because, as you know, the core of their business is live events and news programming. So essentially, my job was to look at the landscape of television and say, what is ESPN not doing? And where, you know, does it match that we can try something new? So, you know, be it some reality shows in the world of sports with, you know, Bob Knight and Barry Bonds and others, or poker, which I came into, you know, maybe a year or two after they had started it. But the goal was every year, how do you make it better? But yes, in general, it was the creative side of the storytelling, but the business side, budgeting, deliverables. You know, there in the case of poker, you have 30 hours of programming to deliver every year, and how to make each of those shows come in on budget and on time. I had a phenomenal team that worked on different projects below me, but you are responsible. And then also the business side of it is dealing with the sales and marketing team to say, you know, how is this going to then be profitable for ESPN? Because in the end, even though you're being creative, it still has to be good for the business.
That's a pretty broad mission statement to say, hey, we've got the day-to-day games and news covered. You come up with other stuff. You know, that's got to be pretty open-ended. Was that inspiring or was that kind of almost daunting?
Oh, I think it was inspiring, and I thought it was really phenomenal that ESPN was, you know, had created this group to do that, because they knew what they were good at, and they knew they were, you know, the best at doing games and delivering on things like SportsCenter and building out the talent for that. But to look at things from the perspective of, you know, what's I like to say, you have to work. It's addition through subtraction. What is not. And if it's not working, what can we put in that time slot? So one example of just something that we did was I was able to meet with a gentleman, Sean Hanrahan, who's still in ESPN and marketing, I would go and meet with the advertisers who were paying for certain properties on ESPN and see if perhaps they could be stretched out to be more on the broadcast side. So something like Sports Nation, which is now a daily show, does very well for ESPN. You know, when we got a hold of it, it was just an element on the website where fans could react and where fans felt they had a voice. So to be able to work directly with Toyota and say, okay, we're going into the upfront season. You have this property. I actually think if we're going to give the fans a voice, that could be a show. And that could change the way that we look at, you know, structuring SportsCenter. What do fans really want to talk about? And are we responding to that? So it ended up, it was good for Toyota. They got a much bigger presence with that show. It was good for ESPN because we filled out a block within the afternoon on ESPN2 at the time. And I was able to bring in talent with my team, of course, a great team of creative folks, to bring in talent that could carry that type of a show, which is a very different personality than a SportsCenter. So it was very inspiring. I mean, I got to do some of the most amazing creative things there. And, you know, ESPN was very supportive of that.
You talked about team a couple of times there, and we both know that it's super important that, you know, one person can't execute all of these things and take it from vision to execution. So your team is vitally important. How would you describe, as you progressed in your career from even ABC to ESPN and et cetera, in your various roles, how did you grow and change as a leader, managing staff, dealing with people, all of those intricate parts of kind of your growth in your career?
Yeah, you know, it's very interesting. I was just having this conversation this morning with a colleague that, and I see this in different articles on LinkedIn, and it's very much appropriate in the world of Working Nation and talking about work, is that I had the real advantage as a child of my father taking me to business meetings. And this was prior to iPhones and iPads, and I would go to business meetings and sit and watch how executives and people in different companies would interact and how they would work together and how they would solve problems. It was very important to him, and it ended up really showing me and laying a groundwork for a lot of things. But the most important to me is to hire people that are better in some ways than you are at a specific skill. So I think a lot of hiring managers are nervous to bring people in that they might look at and say, oh my God, they know more about this particularly than I do. That never made me nervous. That made me excited. First of all, because I was going to continue to learn, and that the product would be better. So, you know, I think I've done that well. I've built incredibly strong teams. I mean, of course, there's mistakes along the way, but really building team members who knew that I was there to support them. I generally say, if you're going to bring me a problem, I also want to know what are your two solutions for it and what would you recommend we do? Very few times in my career, and I remember almost all of them, I'm sure, did someone bring me, you know, a couple of solutions to a problem, and I chose to do something different. So that shows a level of respect that I had for my team. And in those cases, they ended up working out, but I just had a different vision, perhaps, from the management level than they did. But for the most part, it's driving people to be more creative, to come up with solutions. You know, it happens here to Working Nation. Don't come into my office and tell me you have a problem unless you have some plan for how we can potentially fix it. And then I will support you in doing that.
That could be the greatest piece of advice anybody could ever share with our tend to be younger audience, is that, and I felt the same way when I was a new director at Fox Sports Northwest. I would always tell my staff when they came in with questions, like, you need to have gone through the thought exercise of what you think the solution may be, and then we can have that discussion. But I wanted to challenge them to think. And I think that's so important for people coming up in the industry to understand that you're not going to abdicate your thought process in this. You're going to be a part of the decision making. And I think that's really important.
Yeah, and I think so many people have talked to me. My background is so diverse, from being in breaking news, from being, you know, flown to the site of a plane crash in Canada where there was no electricity and we had to figure out how to go live within an hour, to, you know, dealing with unions that were striking in the middle of an election night, all the way through. In every bit of my career, what I love the most is what I call figure it outness. You have to be able to figure out how to get to the end goal. And in news, it was moment to moment, second by second, dire situations. in terms of deadlines. I personally had to really adjust and figure out a different way to do it when I moved from ABC News over to ESPN, where now you're talking about potentially a month or a year before something's being delivered in cases of documentaries. It's a different process. So for myself, that's what I've loved about my career in every place that I've been. It's what am I learning? If I'm not learning something, then I should go somewhere else. But what am I learning? And in the end, am I figuring it out? And I do the same thing for myself. Before I take something to my boss, who's the founder of Working Nation, you know, I have laid out a plan for what I think success would look like. And then I'm able to talk to him about what that means. And I just think that it's key for anybody that wants to have a successful career and a successful interaction with their colleagues or their bosses.
See, so my background in the sports media, much like yours, I tend to hear things in sound bites. And I will tell you, that was a fantastic sound bite. Like everything you just said was like, ooh, that is like, I'm going to snip that out. That's going to be great. You know, I'm always thinking of the next level of it, which is funny. You know, your jobs tend to change your viewpoint on things. So let's talk about your time as your VP when you were a VP. You went from being an EP to jumping to vice president of content and development. And you were one of, if not the highest ranking women in the sports media. What was your frame of mind at this time? Sir. What was that like being an extremely high ranking woman in the role in the sports media world?
You know, I'm not going to lie. It was daunting. I think that there's a lot of things that women in certain male dominated fields go through. There's this, you know, I talk about it with my peers, women in, you know, banking and finance and all of these that are at a high level. You know, I think you have this level of pressure where you feel like you have to prove yourself because, and it's happening a lot now. We see it with what happened with the Me Too. And I'm not talking specifically about abuse, but I'm talking about women that are moving into higher and higher roles. I'm talking about, you know, having more of a diverse working staff. I've talked to my friends and peers that are, you know, African-American who have said to me, you know, when I got moved up, there was people that looked around and said, well, maybe they just got their job because we needed more diversity in management. The same thing happens with women in this field. But I had to step aside from that and recognize that I'd been put in that position because I was trusted, because I worked hard. And so I think that you just have to find a balance where you're not, you know, you're not trying to prove yourself because you feel like anybody's questioning you, but you're just confident in the work that you're doing. And I think in general, ESPN was really smart about this, and John Skipper and Keith Klingscales and others that brought me over, I just added a different perspective. And that's really what diversity is about. It's about perspective. And when you're talking about development, I mean, I would admit, my team would tease me at ESPN, I didn't watch a lot of live sports. I obviously love it, but I would be watching other channels to see what is missing, you know, and we were very early. Our department was very early in the gaming program, and Ann Powell, who worked for me, she did a great show, Madden Nation. Like it was looking at other things and saying, hey, we should give this a shot. And, you know, in the end, people would joke that my job was very much a sales job, because then I'd have to convince the folks at ESPN, here's why I think this is a good idea, when we haven't been doing that before. So it was daunting but exciting. And I'm, you know, I'm very happy to say that, you know, for the most part, everything that we brought them, they fully supported. But that goes back to what I said before. We're bringing them ideas that have a full business plan behind them as well, not I want to do this show, or this athlete has come to us and wants to do a show, so we should just do it because they're a big name. It's whether or not this is good in the end for the business.
I think that's fascinating. Let's lean into that for a second, because during your time as VP, you had a ton of successful projects, 30 for 30, E60, mm-hmm. Sports Nation. You listed some of them yourself. But when you're tasked with, hey, go find other things for us to do, and you're going at it with that perspective, you probably have hundreds of ideas, or you probably have other people pitching you hundreds of ideas. How do you go through a process of determining what will work and what is worth pitching to your bosses? Because not everything can make its way upward.
Right. I mean, my philosophy has been, is this content going to be something where people walk away, in the case of ESPN, walk away knowing more about, in this case, sports or an athlete or a league? Are they going to learn something that they're not learning on some other platform at ESPN? So it's filling a gap. You know, I think we, leading into 30 for 30, when Bill Simmons brought us the idea, we knew that we wanted to do something for the 30th anniversary of ESPN. And there were, you know, people's mouths drop open when I say it, but there were hundreds of pitches for 30 films. And there was a lot of big names that came through the door and pitched, you know, Connor Schell and John Dahl and all of these folks that were working on my team pitched them tons of ideas. And then we really had to break it down and say, okay, you know, what is it that this particular story does that over anything else? I mean, one of the things that I still find interesting is we did 30 films for our 30th anniversary, and we didn't do something on Tiger Woods, arguably one of the biggest names in sports during that 30 years.
Oh, wow.
Changed the sport. And obviously, you know, we weren't doing anything to be, you know, we wouldn't have done anything on any scandal or anything else. But this is a man that literally changed the PGA and also inspired a ton of kids and all that. But we didn't do that story. And when we looked at, you know, we knew we needed to do something with O.J. Simpson, who had changed the world of television, which is one of the reasons that I believed we should do it. Changed 24-hour news, along with being a star athlete and a movie star and all of that. But how do we do it differently? And then had a great pitch on how, you know, the Bronco Chase happened to be on one of the biggest days in sports history, with all of the other things that happened on that day of that year. So, you know, I think it's why it did well then, and it continues to do well and inspire, is people say to me all the time when they hear it, you know, I thought I knew the Ricky Williams story. I thought I knew this story. I thought I knew the Duke story, but I couldn't take my eyes off that. I learned so much. It's also why I think the female demographic did very, very well with 30 for 30, because we were telling just really interesting human stories.
When you mentioned Tiger Woods, is that almost a self-conscious, you know, regret in a way, where you're remembering that time and looking back at some of those decisions? Or is that something you're totally confident in? And I don't even mean it's specific to Tiger Woods, but as you look back now, 10 years later, or whatever time frame it may be, of those hundreds of stories you got pitched, do you look at any of them and say, yeah, maybe we should have told that story? Or do you feel pretty good about that list?
I don't regret. I definitely use the Tiger Woods example as a source of pride for the team that was making the decision. And I also, I'm very confident in the decisions of what was chosen, because it was, back to the word, that was an extraordinarily thoughtful, smart group of people in the room making the final decisions when we had a lot of choices. And we had a lot of celebrity names and athlete names that anybody else would potentially say, yes, you should absolutely do something with this person. That we were allowed, within the context of what we were trying to do, to be really pure about what we wanted in the end, to have a really clear representation story-wise of what did the last 30 years look like and what are some of the best stories. I mean, there's always things that you look back and say, gee, I wish I had told that story. And I never walk away from any piece of content not saying it could have been better.
Right.
I'm just very critical in that way, but that's, but I'm so proud of them. And you know, it's thrilling to see the team under Libby Geist and others continue to put out, you know, just phenomenal stories. And back to the point, this was not something that people thought was going to work. I mean, that's the most underrated project. And I laugh with folks about it. There was definitely people who thought we were making a mistake by doing documentaries. There were definitely people that thought that it would not work on our air. We had done some documentaries before. They were programmed against things like the final night of American Idol. Like, it just internally, there were some folks that thought this is never going to work. But the management and our team, thankfully, and a great marketing team and a great sales team, and I'm really proud of that actual project.
I could likely geek out and ask you another 100 questions on your time at ESPN alone, but I'm, I want to transition a little bit to Working Nation.
Sure.
You are the chief content and programming officer for Working Nation. Please tell us a little bit more about the objective of Working Nation, your role within it, and kind of the overall mission statement.
Sure. I mean, it's funny. If you were to look at my resume and everything that we've gone through so far, and I get this a lot, why this?
Yeah.
You know, did you decide to leave the business? No. Every job, you know, when I first left ABC News to go to Yahoo, I went in the late 90s because I recognized that the internet was going to be a place for content. So I left to develop out the first live streaming programs on Yahoo Finance. Was brought back to do ABC News' first 24-hour channel, then went over to ESPN. So what you're looking at through my career is these development building blocks. I like to build things. I like to build concepts. I like to build teams. And then move on to the next thing. I mean, I'm just not the type of person that would ever have been comfortable working on one show for my whole career. I'm a development person by nature. So what happened with this, and when I get to tell people this, they're fascinated, is that our founder, Art Bilger, who's a venture capitalist, very successful guy, wonderful guy, wonderful family, started recognizing that within his level of peers, so very high level people, there wasn't enough conversation about the changing nature of work and that the lack of education to prepare people for the work of the future and even the work of today. And that the only thing that people were talking about was really the jobs numbers, which is really inadequate when you're talking about this area. So what he came to me with, and I was introduced through Participant Media to him, was essentially, he said, can you create 30 for 30 with work? And I said, absolutely not. That sounds incredibly boring. I will never do that. I never took an economics class. I'm not your girl. And he said, please. And what I did was I said, if you give me 3 months, I will develop out this concept because I need to learn about it. I don't know enough about it. I don't know what structural unemployment is, when he kept using that term. And so I brought in my colleagues that worked for me at ESPN, Melissa Panzer, who now runs video for us. She's our EP. And for 3 months, we took pitches. And I went to people, same model, really, as 30 for 30. I went to directors, celebrities, journalists, and said, tell me what your passion project is. What's the story you most want to tell? And 95% of them were about work, and the people pitching it didn't know it.
Huh.
And so I was stunned. But when I went back to Art, what I said is, I can do this for you, but making documentaries, first of all, it's a very specific audience. It takes a very long time, and it's expensive. What I'm seeing here is, as we say, the slope of the curve is so great in terms of how things are changing in this country with regards to work. We can't wait.
Right.
So what he allowed me to do is build a journalism team so we could be reporting on it every day, and then build a film team so we could be building out content. So there were 700 pieces of content. We report on it every day. And I think the most interesting thing is that when I was building Working Nation to start, before we released any content, and we have a really, really interesting distribution plan or path, is it was during the election year. It was the presidential election year. And I went around and I was in every state talking to people, workers, CEOs, major names. And I was going back to my friends in the news business and saying, I think you're missing the story here. For instance, you can't have a conversation about Bernie Sanders and free education if you're not talking about, even if you have a degree, what are you going to do for a living? And people weren't taking it to that next step. And so I was saying, you know, it's not a clear reporting on what's actually happening. You know, the unemployment number might be low, but there's 7.3 million open jobs in this country that can't be filled.
Right.
And it's not because everybody's working. It's because employers are telling us we can't find the people with the skills. So in terms of what we're doing, it's super interesting. It's all told through human stories. We're hoping to change the dynamic and some of the stigmas around some careers. You know, that whole concept of not everybody has to go to a 4-year college, but my kid will. You know, those types of conversations. So it actually is bringing together all of my experiences through all of my career and building a content company. And because we're in Los Angeles and technically a media company, we have our first film aired, released by CNN Money. We've had four films on through Time Inc. or Fortune. You would never really have in the news business, we would never outsource stories. It would just never be done. But because of my team, you know, my editor-in-chief, Ramona Schindelheim, was an executive at CNBC and the Wall Street Journal and ABC News. We are having conversations with news organizations in a very different way, where we're saying, we're coming to this, we're not political in any way, we're not leaning, we're just telling a story about jobs through human beings. And so we're getting a lot of distribution through news outlets that normally a company wouldn't do. So that's what excites me, because I always want to do something new and different.
So there's so much that I want to unpack there. And I mean, there's so many interesting parts of what you're talking about. Let's get into a little bit of the specifics of the sports industry. Obviously, we are a job board for the sports industry. We promote jobs out there. I have a large audience on this show, and we have forums for them to have conversations with me. We talk all the time, and I'm talking to people who are graduating from good colleges, who are highly motivated. They're getting experience. They're getting their master's a lot of times, and they are still struggling to find jobs. And I find it fascinating that we hear day after day, unemployment numbers are low. And it all sounds great, but people are still struggling to get jobs once they graduate. So ultimately, I would wonder, and I ask you, is unemployment data kind of lacking context? Is there a bigger story there that we're missing? And are people not necessarily aligning their education with what the marketplace is actually in demand for?
Yeah. There's no question that the unemployment numbers are lacking context. There's no question that we don't have, that the numbers and the group of people that are actually counted are not representative. So, you know, and when we throw them out and just say, you know, this has been being reported, and presidents on both sides will, you know, pound their chest and take credit for that. I think what I've found most interesting is going throughout the rest of the country and actually talking to people who are saying that is not representative of my life. And meeting, you know, at one point I met a medical doctor in a food bank, and people look at me like I'm crazy when I say that. Like, technology is changing certain fields, and you either keep up or you're no longer in the workforce. People are staying in the workforce longer as they get older. So we talk about longevity, either because they have to or because they want to. You know, if you're going to live to be 90, and you're supposed to retire at 55, what are you going to do? Even if you could afford it, which most people can't, what are you going to do? So having a conversation about that workforce, having a conversation about the retraining elements of it is incredibly important. But, you know, in the world of jobs, it's easy to have this conversation, and we're doing it for the month of November. Every day we're talking about veterans and work. And actually Clint Eastwood, graciously came in and gave us money to create a lot of content around that topic, because he's really passionate about it. It's easy to talk about veterans coming back and saying their skills don't translate to some of these jobs. It's a real issue in this country. People know about it. But the reality is that difference with people coming out of college into their first jobs is also the same conversation.
Yeah.
Companies are saying they don't have the skills. And educators are saying, we gave them the skills. We gave them a broad education. It's an enormous gap. And Gallup has done a lot of research into it, where I think over 95% of educators said that their graduates were work ready. And 16% of hiring executives or CEOs said people coming out of college were work ready. That is an enormous gap. So having the conversation with folks, and even I just spoke last week, with people to say, okay, you want to be in journalism. Great. There's no area, any field that you go into going forward that won't have some level of data and analytics tied to it. So you have to be willing to take those classes. I think that there's not enough guidance on the high school level, and definitely in the college level, saying, you know, here's something that you really should know about. It's more sort of, here's your core curriculum. Here's what your math, you know, if you're going to be a journalist, you have to take these classes. So I think we need to get more creative and say everybody has to be taking data and analytics classes. It drives every single business and everything that we do. So those conversations, I'm hoping the content of Working Nation can help, because I think there's a lot of people out there that are watching the news and saying, you throw out an unemployment number and I'm underemployed. I'm employed, but I'm way underemployed and I don't know what to do about it.
Yeah, it is really fascinating. And I even say I've interviewed many talent acquisition managers for different sports teams, the Cleveland Indians, the Philadelphia Eagles, the USGA. Yeah. And pretty much universally, they've echoed what you've said, is that the area that they're hiring more than ever in is business analysis, business analytics, yeah, and understanding, yep, how revenue is created and that side of things. And when people think sports, they don't necessarily think about those things. It was literally, 10, 15 years ago that Moneyball came out and everybody started talking about analytics, yep, as it relates to player development, but they don't always consider, yep, it as far as for the business side. Are there others other than that, which I think is extremely important and people should take reference to? Are there other sides of education that people should be leaning into that does represent kind of the future hold on employment?
I'd love to see people have better English skills. That would be nice.
Yeah.
Including myself. I could always be better. I think that there are, there was this whole push 5-10 years ago about coding, right? Everybody was talking about coding. And that has waned a bit. And there was a bunch of pro teams. I think San Francisco 49ers did it, where they would bring in and have coding camps at their facilities. But I ended up being able, I was asked by South by Southwest to do a panel last year. So I moderated it and I also brought in the guests, and I brought in, it was about sports and jobs. And one of the really interesting guys who was on it is a guy that's an SVP at Gatorade. And we had a really fascinating conversation about the science of hydration. And he talked about actually how Gatorade operates, which does make sense, where they're really trying to create a product that better hydrates, that creates better athletes. That's a science area.
Yep.
But the coaches, so they were saying, like, we want people with a science background, but also understand performance and also understand, some of these other areas, perhaps data and analytics. So my perspective is to figure out what it is that most interests you. And if you want to be in the world of sports, it's so broad what you can do. I like to say, it's not about, I want to be LeBron James or I want to be Serena Williams. There are so many areas. From the building of the stadiums is fascinating in terms of, infrastructure and city things. And look what happens in cities when the Olympics come to it, what they do and what they have to do. That's all connected to the overall world of sports. And it's changing the way that it's delivered. I think it's kind of endless. I have talked directly to GMs and coaches and people in the world of sports, because this does have a direct tie to it, who say, and these are big teams who say, we can't find people with those skills, and that meaning sort of having a breadth of skills, but still having, a core understanding of performance and of sports in general.
One of the things that surprises me is when you look at the landscape of upper management in sports teams, right? So the thing that people often take for granted is that jobs in sports don't just revolve around teams, right? There's a lot of other opportunities out there. But GMs of professional teams now are often coming from an economics background or a statistics background or something other, or they're Ivy League trained rather than some grizzled scout that spent all their days in the bleachers. There is a changing fundamental in sports where I think it's being more data driven and more business driven. Yep. And I think that's an angle, yeah, that needs to probably be explored more. In your view, is there benefit to being specific in training and in education? Because a lot of people say, like, hey, I'm going to be a marketing major. And it's like, well, marketing means so many things, right? Do you think it's more beneficial to go really deep into some aspect of marketing? Or do you think it's more beneficial to be more broad in your education? Where is education kind of dropping the ball in this path?
Yeah, that's a good question. And I have to ask people who's responsible for making sure that someone is work ready. And we, yeah, start by saying you are responsible for making sure that you are work ready in a lot of ways. I think in order for, there has to be better communication between hiring managers and entities and the education world. We have seen at Working Nation some phenomenal cases of where a community college, which, you know, historically does not have good graduation numbers or placement numbers, but community colleges who have recognized a spot within their community with an employer saying, I can't find these people, and them saying, we'll create the curriculum with you. We'll give you the workforce. And in some cases, they have 95 to 100% placement into really good jobs. So that I think in terms of what needs to happen, it on the education side, I think educators need to be more open to the concept that they are responsible for who's coming out of their school. You don't hear people talk about, you know, you talk about graduation rates, but what about placement rates? What about placement into careers and not getting a job at Starbucks after you've just spent $100,000 or more on your college education? So there isn't really that accountability there that unfortunately I think should be there. And at the same time, just for employers, and I just spoke in an event, there was a ton, 200 HR directors from businesses that are coming in and saying they also need to understand, because looking at a resume that someone brings in with a liberal arts degree, in a lot of cases, it just gets thrown out, right? If an algorithm doesn't throw it out, a human being might throw it out and say, yep, they don't have the skills for it. Our HR directors, our hiring people, our companies need to also be creative and need to also, you know, like I say about myself, it was an unbelievable jump for ESPN to hire me out of a 24-hour news channel to run unscripted television. But I had some great dialogue back and forth with these folks and was able to show that it's about creating team, it's about delivering, and it's about telling a story. Oh, okay, those are connected. But you know from being at Fox, you know, sometimes somebody will look at a resume and be like, oh, well, he just did events or she just did scripted. That doesn't mean anything other than, you know, yes, that's their background, but what else can they do? Then we have to get creative.
It's so true. And one of the things we've talked about a lot on this podcast is there's a burden on the student while they're in college to start researching what employers want, right? Understand what the marketplace is demanding, and then make a mission statement and a plan for yourself to say, okay, I know what the marketplace wants. Now it's on me to make sure I make my internship choices or my volunteer opportunities or my courses that I select that match the skill set that I need to develop to be marketable. And that's somewhere where people don't always take enough personal pride in that they think just going to class and getting my major and getting my degree is going to be enough. And unfortunately, it's not. There is a higher requirement out there nowadays.
It's completely true. And like I said, I'm really blessed that I had two parents that cared a lot about giving me experience from a young age. My mom ran schools and my dad ran companies in manufacturing. But the defining decision in my life was sort of forced on me by my parents, I'm glad they did, which was my dad, mom saying, you can go wherever you want to go to college, but it has to be a co-op program, period. You have to leave college with a year's experience in something. You have to figure out if that is something you want to do so that when you're a year into it, 2 years into it, you know that that's the path that you want to take. And I did the co-op program at Virginia Tech for journalism. I did my first internship at 19 at ABC up in New York, and they hired me and moved me to New York. So I was working full-time at ABC News by the time I was 20 and going to school full-time because they said, we'll hire you. We want you here, but you have to go to school and finish. So I went to school. I went to Fordham and worked at ABC News full-time in order to finish. So my story is really unique, but what is open to people is understanding that co-op program, those internships, they matter. And just as much as, you know, oh my God, I love this, I'm going in the right direction, is I don't love this. I've heard many stories of people that get out with a 4-year degree in education and go in and say, oh my God, I don't like kids.
Right.
I don't like, you know, like that's a really, or nursing school, or that's a little different probably because of the hands-on training, but this is a real thing.
It is.
And it's what we know with apprenticeship programs that are really strong in the UK, really strong in Germany. And I don't want to get into the politics or the policy of how that's paid for by the government and all of that. But at the core, what they're saying is, how do we get you on a path towards something and give you the skills along the way? And during that process, you might find out this is not what I want to be doing.
Yep.
But that takes personal responsibility and awareness.
I try as best I can to come up with unique questions for every single interview that I conduct. And I've done 150 of these at this point. But I generally, in every conversation, gravitate back towards whoever I'm interviewing, whether it's an executive or whoever it may be. When you're hiring staff, what are you looking for? How do you pick somebody out and know that they're going to fit your culture and your environment and that they have the right skills and all those things? How do you pick somebody out of a staff of many applicants? And almost to 100%, everyone always talks about soft skills. They always say, I want somebody with work ethic and I want somebody that shows up on time and I want somebody with leadership skills. And it's like, okay, that's great, but you can't say that on your resume and get noticed. Like, there's still other things that go into getting noticed. But with that said, in your view, as the workplace is changing, I mean, we have more automation, we have more, all these issues going on in the workplace. What is that thing, whether it's a soft skill or a hard skill or whatever it may be, whatever your mind takes you to, what is that thing that you think will be an important part of the equation moving forward over the next 5 to 10 years?
Well, I would say 100% the most important thing in terms of my hiring, and I have a great track record with it, a couple of mistakes along the way, is a level of humility. Because the only way to get better in your career and in your life is to have an understanding of what you have done that has not worked. I just read a great article from the woman, and I forget her name, but the woman that founded Spanx, it was on LinkedIn, and I shared it on my LinkedIn page, where she said that every week her father asked her, what did you fail at this week? And then he would give her a high five. And I got chills when I read it, because people come in, and we do. We've all interviewed for jobs. You go in and you want to present yourself as this very successful person, very, you know, very aware of what that company is, having done the research. But the level, the ability to be humble, in my belief, at least in the very different other fields, I can't speak to those. But for me, in telling stories, you have to be able to understand and get better and be able to say, hey, that didn't work, so why not this? That's why I always say, like, don't tell me no. Why don't we say, what if? What if we change this? What if we change that? And that, to me, is key. And the second one is just going back to what I said before, the figure it outness, the tactical side. Like, I have hired people where it didn't work that were unable to come up with solutions. And so, you know, creating situations and getting and figuring out how to fix things and being solution oriented, that all comes back to understanding what hasn't worked and figuring out why not. It's like, I always say development is like engineering in some ways. It's like, this machine isn't working. Why? Let's go back into it and figure out what parts are not working. It's the same with development. But we have to be able to look, find the solution, and then move forward. So, you know, I don't want everybody that hears this when they do interview with me to come in and be like, oh, here's where I've messed up. That's definitely not what I'm saying.
Just start with that.
I think it is the kind of conversations that I try to have with people. And I also try to bring that when I'm talking to my employers about, here's where my responsibility is. And I take that very seriously. So if you would say that's a soft skill, yeah, I guess it's a soft skill. But I think the recognition of that has always, to me, been a part of the best people that I've had work for me. And I have had phenomenal career of people that have worked for me who I've learned so much from. I'm very, very grateful for that.
Joan, I think that's a beautiful place to end. I think that was a fantastic answer and extremely informational. Thank you so much for coming on. There's so much you've shared in here that's going to be beneficial to our audience, and I just can't thank you enough. Thank you.
That was such a pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Wow, that was fun. I seriously could have talked like 30 for 30 for hours with Joan. And then in the second half, I could have kept going and going and going on the future of sports employment stuff. But we were already hitting like the 45-minute mark, and hey, people have to go on with their day. I can't just keep pestering her all day long, like a little, you know, bug in her ear, asking more and more questions. Good times. And thanks to Joan for coming on the show, carving out a little bit of her schedule to talk with us. And you should really check out workingnation.com. There's a lot of great research there and information. Joan does a really great job on the storytelling side of things, and taking her 30 for 30 type abilities and putting them into the working employment world is really cool. And of course, I implore you again to subscribe to the podcast, download more episodes, share with friends, and leave us a great review wherever you listen. All right, thanks, everybody. It's time to get back to work.